The basic laws of physics are pretty clear. A body at rest tends to stay at rest. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. That is, unless something happens. Then you gotta figure it out. Maybe adjust and move forward. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of November 7th, 2014. Our show this week is about moving forward after an accident, an illness, an election. How we make it work, at work and in life. As always, come share your stories with us at MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
Initial jobless claims move from a slightly revised 288 down 10,000 to 278.
Four states supported measures to increase minimum wages in Tuesday's midterm elections: Alaska, Arkansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota.
The balance of power on Capitol Hill has shifted to the Republicans, but what happens now?
Well, let's talk about what happens now, moving forward after the election. And it's the weekend, so let's have brunch. We are out having brunch in New York at the Pullman Kitchen on 2nd Avenue, and today I am joined by Raihan Salam, who's the executive editor of the National Review, and Nicholas Carlson, chief correspondent for Business Insider. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Clink. We can clink. I want to start with the midterm elections. Raihan, this is your party. If we have this big wave election, you think about a regular family sending their kids to school, putting food on the dinner table every night. What changes? Do your taxes change? Does your health care change? I think it's pretty questionable that any major policy changes are going to happen to Obamacare. Well, tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, big thing for people to keep in mind is that, you know, this was actually one of the least consequential elections in recent memory. We've had a lot of really big, important elections. 2012 was a legitimately big, important election. Republicans were genuinely really sad to lose it because, in a way, that was an opportunity to change a lot of stuff. But losing the presidential election that year, you know, you basically had the fiscal cliff. It was resolved. Not prettily, but it was resolved. You know, you had the course set for fiscal policy in a more or less stable way. And guess what? The economy is still really crappy. It's really crappy for ordinary people that you're talking about. But
it is
better than it was before. It's better than it was before. And for the kind of people who vote, the kind of people who are vocal, I'm sorry to say this, but, you know, for those people, we're no longer in crisis mode. Mm-hmm. And so, frankly, the public lost interest. This was an election with really low turnout. Yeah. And so part of the reason is because, look, the broad outline of policy are set for now. The question is, can you put a marker down for the future, for really changing things for ordinary people?
I want to talk about the minimum wage, because one other thing that happened in this election was a lot of individual places have raised the minimum wage, and yet I don't see movement on a large level or enthusiasm for that to happen at a federal level. What do you guys make of the way that affects things? Are we just talking about an America where things are siloed into so many different economies, where everything's local?
To me, it was one of those interesting things where it's, you know, the people who, that when it comes down to their own pocketbook, they're sort of like, yeah, we'd love the raise. I'll vote for that. And they maybe they're, it was because they weren't voting for a party. They were voting in a referendum. They weren't necessarily looking it through to the lens of, oh, this is a Republican thing to do or a Democratic thing to do. They're like, oh, pay me more money. Sure, check.
I guess I see it a little differently. I mean, I think that it's a reflection that there is a lot of diversity in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And I think that for Republicans, I mean, a lot of them are representing parts of the country where the cost of living is really low.
It's very low.
And so are wages. Yeah. So the whole thing about the whole conceit about raising the minimum wage is that, well, look, this just gets passed on to consumers. Now, guess what? If you're a consumer in Arkansas, as opposed to a consumer in Alaska or Nebraska, or let alone Connecticut or the Bay Area or these other places, Bay Area, I'm paying a little bit more for my latte. You know, in Arkansas, gosh, paying a bit more is going to bite for a lot of people. So I think that, you know, that's the reason why a one-size-fits-all policy, in my view, doesn't make sense. And I think that's why national Republicans often feel that way.
All right, I want to shift to another really big business, which seems like it's dominating everything, but is really disappointing investors. Amazon.
These investors are stupid.
Why are they stupid?
Yeah, we might agree on
Tell
this.
Tell me why you think they're stupid.
Why are they stupid? Because I think that Amazon is actually the way companies should be. Okay, so they released this really stupid kind of crappy phone, except that stupid crappy phone has a thing called Mayday that could actually be a huge business for them. They're going to try again.
Explain Mayday.
I don't even know how to explain it. I mean, Nicholas would do a better
job
explaining it
than me.
That's
like a help button on your phone.
That's like instant and kind of connects you to an actual person. They don't just sit on huge amounts of money. They're like, let's do something. Let's like invade someone else's space, make them work harder. And by the way, even if it screws up, we will learn something from this process. That's the way capitalism should work, and it doesn't work that way 9 times out of 10.
So people are looking at Amazon, and they're freaking out because it doesn't make a profit. And they're saying they're trying all these new things, and they don't seem to be getting adoption. But here's what Amazon's doing. One is they're giving away lots of free stuff for cheap if you happen to have a $79 Prime, or I think it's actually more now, annual membership to Amazon. And you get free shipping, you get all these sorts of things. But it's also, you know, another way of thinking about the same thing is that Amazon wants to build an Amazon world for you just to live in. So whenever you even like think about buying something, the first thing you do, pop open any phone, any device, flick to your Amazon app, search for it, bang, one button, it's purchased and on your way to your home. The second thing that Amazon doing is spending a lot of money and on purpose not making a profit. And what it's doing is creating a moat. It's saying like, we're going to make this product so great that no one will, this is what you expect out of e-commerce from now on. And if you don't get this, you're not going to use the product. And to develop that kind of product costs billions of dollars.
All right, let's get weird. Either of you have cool, weird stories from the week that have gripped your mind.
Nicholas, what did you think about the lady who crowdfunded paying her $360
yes!
Uber ride?
Yes, okay, no, this is, okay, this is
I
actually
will tell you what I think about it in a moment, but I would like to hear what you think about it.
This woman took a Halloween Uber ride. She had a few drinks. She may not have noticed the surge pricing, so she says it was, what, a couple $100?
It was $360, if I recall correctly.
You know what? The Uber makes you put in the number. They do that now.
Yep, they make you put in the multiple. That's right.
It's as clear as can be.
It's like their version of a breathalyzer test.
It really is. And so I think she owes Uber $360, and anybody who pays for her ride is a sucker.
There's actually been a lot of interesting Uber news this week, like Natasha Tiku. She wrote a neat piece just about the car loans that Uber kind of semi-secures for its drivers. And it's just so interesting to me because we demonize this company that's basically just bundling a lot of things that exist in the world, but they just put them together in a new way, and then we hate it.
Tie it all together. It's like, you know, new Congress comes in. People don't like change. They do. They do not like big change. They like,
or they think they like change, and
they like cosmetic change.
Then there's a big moment of trying to figure out what change means.
Totally.
Nicholas Carlson and Raihan Slam, thank you guys so much.
Cheers.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Our next story about moving forward is about the commercial space industry. After two recent high-profile accidents, the crash of Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2, which killed the pilot and injured the co-pilot, and the explosion of Orbital Sciences' Antares rocket, we invited Mike Gold to come on the show. He's the chairman of the FAA's Commercial Space Transportation Advisory Committee. He also works with Bigelow Aerospace as the director of DC operations. It's a space startup planning to launch their own space station in the future. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you.
I wonder what you were thinking when you saw that Virgin Galactic accident.
Well, the first thing you think about are the people and the families that were affected. And that, of course, is a terrible tragedy. But what we were also thinking is that this is inevitable. This was going to happen. Unfortunately, space is difficult, and risk and loss is part of the activity.
I have a hard time believing that the Virgin Galactic incident and Antares didn't have some impact on the business model of the various companies doing this. Didn't you guys sit back and say, whoa?
Well, I don't think anyone sees these failures and says, well, that's a great thing. You know, I can certainly assure you it wasn't beneficial. But what was extraordinary to us is the success, the amazing consecutive successes that the Falcon 9 and the Antares had up to this point, not that there was a failure. So if anything, the performance of, you know, particularly the SpaceX systems have exceeded our expectations.
What happens on an operational and business level when something like this happens?
Even with well-established rockets, failures still occur. So the best solution that you have is to move forward with multiple entities. It's common sense. Whether you're building a apartment complex or a hotel terrestrially or building a space station, good contracting practices are just as valid in space as they are here on Earth. So when it comes to crew transportation or cargo transportation, you have to have more than one system, both to retain economic competition as well as safety and redundancy, and that's the best way to deal with failures that inevitably will occur.
The history of the U.S. space program, if you think about maybe the Mercury program or the Apollo program, those are big government programs. And I wonder if private industry has the same kind of stomach for loss that the government had over a very long time.
You know, it's a good question, and I like the context you put it in because we hear far too often that commercial entities will be less safe than government programs when exactly the opposite is the case. That you talk about Mercury and Apollo and other programs, they to an extent could suffer failure more easily than a commercial program because if you look at the activities of these purely commercial entities such as Virgin Galactic, it's their own money, their own investors, and they don't necessarily have the depth of resources, which is why, quite frankly, I think there is at least an equal, if not a stronger focus by these commercial and private sector companies in safety and success. Because if we fail, our jobs go away, the programs go away, and that's not necessarily always the case with, you know, government programs.
Michael, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Stay tuned. We've got more Marketplace Weekend coming up after the break. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
You tell me, who is your daddy and what does he do?
This is Tech in Real Life.
This week, we're doing something a little different. Often on this segment, we like to profile a business that embodies how technology shapes our lives. Not too long ago, we spotted the technology to test who you are and where you come from, parked across the street from New York's Grand Central Station. It's a mobile DNA truck offering access to a technology that, not too long ago, wasn't readily available. We met the owner, Jared Rosenthal, outside his truck, and there's a reason crowds gather to take pictures.
It's a big blue RV, and we have a big painted logo in graffiti style. It says DNA testing, and underneath DNA testing, we have the slogan, "Who's your daddy?" You guys want to come inside?
Yeah, I want to come inside. So we're sitting in your RV here. How'd you get into this business? What were you doing before?
Initially, I painted the RV myself, and I got this sticker, this I blew up basically a sticker of a cup of pee, and I put it on the side of the truck. We would pull up at a job site to test the workers, and they would see the big cup of pee coming, and some of them would be like, take it off, you know, running away. So the company started asking, hey, don't bring the pee mobile the next time, you know. I decided we had to really, you know, change the branding. Right around the same time, actually, my best friend got contacted by this girl saying that she was his 18-year-old daughter that he never knew about, and he came to me and said, all right, let's figure this out, and kind of figured out how to do the paternity testing. You know, I was already working with labs doing the drug testing, so it was an easy add-on.
Was she his daughter?
Yeah, she was.
Walk me through what kind of tests you guys do.
The most obvious is the paternity test.
Which the who's your daddy test.
Right, the namesake test of the company, who's your daddy.
These tests are pretty expensive. Some of them, you know, more than $200, $300.
Yeah.
How's business?
It depends how you define success, I guess. You know, financially, it's a grind. But, you know, I get to be there at some incredible moments. You know, like I've had brothers that meet for the first time right here in this truck. And I get to open up the results right in front of them and tell them, that's your long-lost brother. I mean, it's a pretty incredible thing that I get to experience. So from that standpoint, it's very successful.
How does this work? I mean, you know, one question I have walking up to the truck is, you drive around, you go in different neighborhoods. Who, you know, spots a truck on the street and is like, you know what, forget it. I'm not going to go on Maury Povich. I'm going to go into that truck right now and figure out if this is my kid.
It's a lot more common than people think. I think what's happened with shows like Maury and the daytime talk shows is that it's perpetuated this stereotype of, you know, DNA testing is only in certain communities and it's only certain income groups. It's people that don't want to be the father of his kid and they want to, you know, jump up and dance if it turns out they're not the father. And, you know, all of that is just wrong. I mean, all of it, it's you know, I see every single day just how many people need it, just how many different walks of life. Every neighborhood I go to, we have customers, a lot more people than is generally understood. You know, it's not the kind of thing where you go out with your friends and say, I slept with a man that's not my husband, and I'm not sure if my husband's the father of my kid.
How do you decide where you're going to park the truck?
Based on what I'm in the mood to eat for lunch.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's the misconception. People always want to say, oh, park this in my neighborhood, or park this uptown, or park this in the Bronx, you know. But it's everywhere. Anywhere I go, there's interest.
Tell me the story of a big surprise you've seen in this truck.
Wow. The toughest ones are when people don't have a suspicion and they're not getting the test because they suspected anything, but they were required to get a test for whatever legal reason, and all of a sudden find out that they're not related to the person that they thought they were related to.
I wonder if there's something you've learned about what it actually means to be family.
Half the people put an incredible emphasis on the biological relationship. And then there's another half who say, she could be my kid or not. I'm going to adopt her. I'm going to raise her. I'm going to love her the same. And they really mean it, you know. So it's a very personal decision.
Do you think people are a little sketched out by getting their DNA tested in an old RV?
I think it's the opposite. You know, it's
really? How?
There's a lot of great doctors out there to get people to open up, but a lot of them also scare people away. Something pretty cool happens when people come in the RV and, you know, they just kind of open up and it's a lot more comfortable to them and it's more natural. It's right here on the street. I'm not wearing a white coat. I'm in a hoodie, you know. It's the hoodie effect, maybe. And what's amazing is that it's so simple. I mean, it's just a cheek swab. It's 10 seconds. You know, some people have been waiting 30 years to get the test.
So what happens? You swab my cheek and then?
And then we package it up, send it to our laboratory. It's professionally analyzed.
How long does it take to get the results?
About a week.
And I've got to supply you with whoever's DNA, right? If we're trying to test me against somebody else?
Yeah, that's the thing. You do need two people. It's not as if you just swab yourself and we could find your long-lost mom or something like that. However, there are cases where people bring specimens like hair or teeth or, you know, if somebody's deceased. I've gone into funeral homes, morgues, and cutting, you know, a chunk of somebody's leg to get tested. Yeah.
How much money are you making?
Money?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just outrunning all the parking tickets and the gas. You got to stay ahead of the bills. It's not easy. But what I thought in doing it as a mobile business was, instead of being in one office in one neighborhood, I can put it out there and be in every neighborhood, you know, with rent being what it is in New York. It's not a bad deal for me.
Jared Rosenthal, thank you so much.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
You can get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app from the iTunes Store or on Google Play. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. This next story about moving forward is a little different because it's personal. It's about egg freezing and what that means for women at work. News broke that Apple and Facebook would pay to differing degrees for employees to freeze their eggs. Now, Citigroup says they too provide coverage for egg freezing. And I thought, okay, I'll talk about it. This show is about how the economy collides with real life. Well, here's how it collided with mine. A few years back, I got sick. I have a condition called endometriosis, where uterine tissue grows in places it shouldn't, and it can make it hard to have kids. So, in between surgeries, bookending a few years of my life, I froze my eggs. It cost me $7,000. Insurance covered the drugs, which were $1,800. The rest I paid out of my own pocket. Storage runs about $300 a year. It was scary, painful, and expensive. And I still don't know if all that money and effort will ever be worth it, because the science is pretty new. But I do know that I bought myself maybe a little confidence to go forward in my career and not worry late at night that I'm throwing away my chance to be a mother, because I love my job. And if more companies are going to pay for women to have this expensive chance, what does that mean? Maybe greater freedom to work in your 20s and 30s? We went to see Dr. Jamie Knopman. She is a fertility specialist at Reproductive Medicine Associates here in New York. I asked her if having your job pay for freezing your eggs means you end up tied to that company.
I mean, I was surprised at how much like backlash there was, like, of people being like, oh my goodness, like, this is companies wanting women just to like delay and accept. Like, I didn't think, I really, my first impression when I heard it, I was like, oh, awesome. I didn't think like that that was how people would react. You know what I'm saying? I was just surprised.
The kind of women who come in here, what do they ask you when they walk in the door?
I think people are very eager to see what their fertility is or to see where they are in their biological clock, because I think the more that we sort of talk about it, the more the women are curious to see what's going on in their own body.
In this practice, what percentage would you say of the work that you do is about egg freezing?
I see a good number of egg freezing patients. I would say at least probably 40% of my practice is made up of women freezing their eggs.
And who are they?
I would say most of the patients are probably now in their mid to late 30s, usually professional women, you know, who are pretty successful in their career, who are now coming in and want to talk about preserving their fertility.
I would imagine that a lot of your egg freezing patients are driven and successful.
Correct, yes.
And used to being good at stuff.
Yes, very true.
How do you couch that with, here is something that you're going to pay a fair amount of money for that you might not succeed at?
Yeah, I think that's very sort of an interesting way to put it, is that most patients see it as like another job. You know how like when you get to work, like you have a checklist of the things you have to do for the day? So this becomes in a lot of ways like something on the checklist of life. And if you cannot check that box, meaning let's say you go through egg freezing, you only make a couple of eggs where you hoped to make, you know, more, 10 or whatever it is, it's sometimes for a lot of women brings them a lot of disappointment, because it's like a box they may never be able to check, and it can be a very anxiety provoking.
Most of the women you see, does their insurance cover some of this? Are they totally self-pay? Do we even have a sense yet?
Most people are totally self-pay. Sometimes their insurance will cover the medications, because sometimes the medication portion of their insurance doesn't separate, are you freezing, egg freezing or doing IVF. So sometimes people will get a benefit with that. But I have not really seen many plans cover elective egg freezing.
You view these companies offering this plan as what?
I think it's a good thing. I don't think that women, if you want to have a baby, then you should have a baby. I don't think that the companies are saying, don't have a baby, you know, work harder, be here till 11 o'clock in the morning and come back, you know, the next day at 7. I really, and maybe I'm being naive, but I don't think that's what they're saying. If you look at the rest of their benefit packages, they offer pretty awesome benefits to their employees. You get like $4,500 in baby cash, or they have, you know, daycare on site. So I really think that what they're trying to say is that we have a lot of female employees who are not having children, you know, at a certain age, and we want to help them so that when they do want to have children, they have that opportunity.
Jamie Knopman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We just heard about what egg freezing might mean for a working woman, but what about for the companies themselves? Is there some benefit to adding this to, well, your benefits package? that's where Bruce Elliott comes in. He's the manager of compensation and benefits at the Society for Human Resource Management. They study HR around the world. I asked him what he thought when he first heard about Apple and Facebook and egg freezing.
I wasn't surprised, given that there is a real perk war going on right now in Silicon Valley. And the technology companies, especially the large ones, seem to be going out of their way to outdo themselves. And given the amount of press that's been going on right now with regard to diversity in Silicon Valley, this benefit seems like a natural progression with regard to some of the things they're trying to do around diversifying that workforce.
Do you look at Silicon Valley as an outlier in terms of the benefits they provide, or are they the leading edge of a curve?
I think they're an incubator, quite frankly. You know, if we looked back in the early part of 2000, the 2000s or the aughts, late 90s, they were the first ones to come up with concierge benefits, you know, where you could get your hair cut, your car washed, you could have somebody go out and do your grocery shopping for you, you know, that type of thing. And the reason for implementing those types of benefits was to keep the employees at their desks and working and being productive. This seems to me to be a natural extension of that.
So do you think we're going to see more companies follow suit? We're already seeing a couple of big banks say, hey, we're going to do this.
And again, that's a natural progression if they're looking to diversify their workforce. So yeah, I do think that this may be the beginning of a trend. I don't know that it'll be broad-based, but you know, in a lot of male-dominated businesses, such as financial services, investment banking, technology, professional services and consulting, those firms that are seeking to diversify their workforce and make themselves more attractive to women, I think that this is absolutely going to give them an edge.
So if companies might get an edge in the talent war, one question is why not do this sooner? Elliott's colleague, Evren Essen, says it mirrors other changes in what companies are willing to offer, like when some began paying for in vitro fertilization, or IVF.
That was also a benefit that really stood out because it's something that is a high-cost benefit for employers. But it's something that employees that are struggling with infertility issues really need and would value. So that was also a benefit that stood out when it first started.
And how commonplace is it now?
Right now, about a little over a quarter of companies, 26% in 2014, offer that benefit. And it's remained steady over the last 5 years.
I guess one question I have is, do you think benefits packages change the behavior of employees in terms of what you've seen?
Well, I think they can. I think when companies offer benefits that they think will be beneficial to their members, I mean to their employees, excuse me, then we do see that employees start thinking about what they may want to do in terms of their health and wellness, their retirement, any wide array of benefits that the organization may offer, they start thinking about their behaviors differently.
Does that hold true in both genders, or is there any difference when you look at men and women?
I think it holds true in both genders. Organizations have benefits that appeal to all of their employees, whether they're men or women.
One reaction to all of this has been, wait a minute, is this a way to just keep women working constantly and say, you know what, your best years, you're going to spend them here at the office?
Well, I think this benefit is it offers women a choice. And there's no pressure to utilize this benefit if a person doesn't want to. But it does give women choices in their career and in the workplace.
Evren Essen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the weekend number. It's 4%. American women's earnings at work decrease 4% for every child they have. That data comes from a study at the University of Massachusetts. And yes, it controls for education, hours, and different types of jobs. Later on the show...
My advice is I like to shop, and I'm not going to stop shopping. I don't care. I've spent my last money on another shirt or something.
because I go to work to pay for that shirt I just bought so I can buy another shirt next week. And I'm not going to break it. I'm sorry. This is something I've been going for 20 years. It's not going nowhere.
Your stories of financial vices. That's coming up on Marketplace Weekend from APM. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Last week, we asked you to tell us about the vices that eat away at your bank account. Mine is definitely late-night online shopping. We invited Christina LaMontagne, NerdWallet's General Manager of Health, to explore how vice intersects with your wallet. Christina LaMontagne, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you for having me.
I want to listen to these voices we've collected, people talking about their vices. Let's go ahead and play those.
Spending on shoes. I love comfortable shoes. I like the comfort, but I feel guilty spending a little extra on nice comfortable shoes, but 8 hours a day standing.
Smoking, and I'm a single mom, so I have a lot to spend my money in.
We buy the coffee and smoke the cigarettes. And it's something, the donuts or something like that. It's too much money, you know. Almost $10 we lose on the morning every day.
Ice cream, for one, and dessert, because life is too short to do without it.
My advice is I like to shop, and I'm not going to stop shopping. I don't care. I'll spend my last money on another shirt or something. Because I go to work to pay for that shirt I just bought so I can buy another shirt next week. And I'm not going to break it. I'm sorry. This is something I've been going for 20 years. It's not going nowhere. Just throw the shirt in the coffin with me when I pass.
Vices? I eat too much.
Smoking. Because I enjoy it. I'll spend it on something else. I'll spend it on another vice.
If it weren't cigarettes.
Yeah.
Dessert, of course. I love dessert, so I don't mind spending a little extra to have a nice dessert.
Shopping, sometimes I overdo it.
America is expensive country. You know that, huh?
Christina LaMontagne, when you listen to people talk about their vices, we hear familiar things. Cigarettes, coffee, sweets. They seem to speak of them, though, with a little bit of fondness. Why do you think that is?
I also caught that hint of fondness. You know, we work hard in our jobs every day, and we're proud of the money that we earn. And I think people need that release that comes with buying the things that matter most to them. So it's fair. It's certainly fair for people to spend their money to make themselves a little bit happier in life.
What do you think defines a vice, anyway?
You know, I think a vice is something that we cling to, probably for an emotional reason, more than anything, and it becomes a habit in our lives. And then over time, you know, maybe we start to think if it's such a good habit after all. But I think a vice is just something that becomes a routine in our lives, and we sometimes resent that it exists.
You write about health and think about health, and in doing that, think about maybe some vices that some of us don't. What's out there that you think is surprising?
Well, I was thinking about the biggest vice, and perhaps one is procrastination. You know, so many of us like to put things off. And with your health, that can really add up to a lot of money over time. I myself neglected to get a flu shot in September. I live in California. It was still sunny out, and it just didn't occur to me that winter was coming. I'm fortunate in that way, in fact. But wouldn't you know, I got sick in early October and, you know, really regretted having not taken that initial preventive step, paid a little bit of money, $25 at my pharmacy, perhaps. You know, instead, I was sick for 3 or 4 days and lost a whole lot of productivity. And, you know, that has financial implications that all of us might think about.
I think that question of something more nebulous as a vice, as opposed to a thing, a quantifiable thing, that might be something we overlook.
It really is. You know, I dug into this issue of procrastination because I wondered about some of the real life implications of this. And I went to CheapAir.com, and CheapAir projects that the most cost-efficient time to purchase your ticket. So the most inexpensive time to purchase your airline ticket is 54 okay. days in advance of your flight. And if you wait until the last minute, say only 2 weeks ahead of time, that price goes up by 20% or more. So there are really tangible examples of how this procrastination can add up in our lives.
What else is out there that you think might not be on somebody's everyday radar screen?
You know, one other outside of the box kind of less tangible vice that I'd like to share with your listeners is the vice of not asking for help, of thinking that we are self-sufficient and have all the answers. You know, and a clever example perhaps on this is when you fail to ask for directions and you circle around in your car for an extra 20 minutes burning gas. We all know that gas can be pretty expensive.
And, I hope my dad is listening to this episode.
That's right. So, you know, not asking for help can certainly add up. You know, and this also might apply to things that are just tough for us, like, you know, picking the right 401k plan or picking the right insurance. It's now open enrollment period, and I do think a lot about healthcare. And not asking for help can really add up when there are experts or blog posts or, you know, lots of good information out there, and no one needs to make a split second decision that may lead them to a more costly outcome.
Christina LaMontagne from NerdWallet, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to everyone who spoke to us this week about vice.
My name is Luis Gallegos.
Hi, my name is Maribel Navarro.
My name is Petros Davtian.
Hi, I'm Catherine LeBlanc.
My name is Alfonso Lee.
Kinder Lewis.
Julian Davis.
Next week, we're exploring how you've tried to make money out of your passion. Art, music, theater, basket weaving. How'd it go? How much support did you get? Go ahead and tell us on our website, marketplaceweekend.org, or tweet us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. Know the name Santiago Swallow? He may be one of the more famous people no one has heard of. At one point, he had 80,000 Twitter followers. So how did Swallow get that kind of internet fame? Well, let's say author Kevin Ashton was his consultant of sorts about how to build a personal brand for the digital age. Ashton explains.
Santiago is a Mexican-American public speaker, futurist, writer. He is, the kind of guy you'd see at a TED conference, very big on Twitter, has a very interesting Wikipedia biography. He also is completely fictitious, and I made him up. How do the 80,000 Twitter followers think that he's real? You are assuming that the 80,000 Twitter followers are real too. In fact, 79,000 of the 80,000 Twitter followers were also fake. To establish his credibility quickly, I published a Wikipedia biography of him and gave him a homepage that talked about his alleged book. And for $50, I was able to furnish him with 80,000 fake Twitter followers. He's actually a mashup of three photos that I found on Google Images. Yeah, he's so much better looking than me. It was challenging for me because having created him and he had far more Twitter followers than I've ever had, there definitely came a moment when I could see there was a danger of Santiago taking over and sort of becoming the Mr. Hyde to my Dr. Jekyll. The online world makes it easy to recreate your identity, which is something we all do a little bit. Everybody has a Facebook account, and probably our profile picture is one of the better pictures we've ever had taken. But then when you can, you know, buy 80,000 fake Twitter followers for $50 and create your own face and your own name and your own biography, none of which is true, can really, you know, push that to the extreme and create a complete alter ego. And naturally, the alter ego is more fascinating than you are, so why wouldn't you want to be that person? I think it means we have to apply the same diligence to a social media interaction that we would apply to a real-world social interaction. It does also raise some deeper questions about how hungry we can be for status. You know, why is it that for some people, not all, but for some people, the apparent attention of followers on Twitter is so desirable that you're willing to cheat? It took me about 4 hours to create Santiago from beginning to end and cost $68. So if you are a highly dishonest person and you think having a what publishers and job interviewers and people call a platform matters, you know, you could be listening to this now, and by this time tomorrow morning you could apparently be incredibly influential online.
That was author Kevin Ashton on how to be internet famous for $68. Ashton's book, How to Fly a Horse, The Secret History of Creation, Invention, and Discovery, comes out in January. And this story got our digital mastermind, Seth Kelly, curious about those fake Twitter followers. So he dug a little deeper. Hi, Seth.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
What is a fake Twitter follower?
So when you look at your Twitter account, you can see a follower number next to your profile. And most people will assume that all of those followers are actual real people sitting behind a computer screen operating that Twitter account. But it turns out that there are tons of robots on Twitter, and these are also known as Twitter bots. The distinction between a Twitter bot and an actual follower is just that. It's not a real person.
So how did Kevin Ashton calculate fake Twitter followers anyway?
Kevin Ashton used this online application called Status People, and it says that it will calculate for you how many of your followers are fake, how many are inactive, and how many of them are good or real actual people that are interacting with you. So I went on to Status People and looked up my own Twitter account. I entered in my information to see how many of my followers were fakers. So I don't have very many Twitter followers, but I was pleasantly surprised to find out that only 1% of my followers are fake.
Now, I gather that you ran this test on somebody else?
Indeed I did, Lizzie. I ran it on you. And what I found out, are you ready?
Yeah, go for it. Hit me up.
What I found out, and it's not 100% foolproof. We don't know whether these are actual robots or just people who aren't really using their Twitter accounts. But according to Status People, 21% of your Twitter followers are fake, 29% are inactive, and only 50% are real interactive people.
That's so depressing.
It depends on how you look at it. I mean, on the bright side, Justin Bieber only has 60% of his Twitter followers as real interactive people. So comparatively, you're only doing slightly worse.
You can read all of Seth's story and dig into the world of fake followers. Where can they read it?
MarketplaceWeekend.org.
And if you're real, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We have another story about moving forward now, or trying to. Ishmael Diabate is a 25-year-old from Guinea in West Africa. He makes his living repairing shoes in the suburbs of Rabat, Morocco. He tried to reach Spanish territory, but failed, and he told our partners at the BBC about his journey and why he's saving for a plastic boat to try another crossing to Europe.
My name is Ishmael Diabate. I have Malian citizenship, but I'm originally from Guinea. I'm 25 years old. I immigrated to Morocco because of the economic situation in Guinea. First, I traveled to Mali. I stayed in Mali for around a month. There, I worked and managed to save $60. With that money, I was able to buy a Malian passport, and from Mali, I moved to Algeria. Then I worked again in order to save the $400 to be able to get to Morocco. Since I was a child, I wanted to immigrate to Europe. But because I have no chance of getting a visa, I decided to go to Morocco to be able to cross to Spain, as Morocco is the gateway to Europe. Eventually, I managed to get to Oujda in Morocco. And from Oujda, I went to the Spanish enclave Melilla. Melilla is the first door to Europe because it's a part of Spain inside Morocco. To get into Melilla, you have to climb 3 7-meter-high fences. I managed to get past the fences, but the Spanish border police caught me and handed me to Moroccan police, who took me to the Moroccan-Algerian border again. I've lost many of my friends who died trying to cross the sea to Spain. These kind of incidents happen a lot. It even happened to me once. The boat was broken in the middle of the sea, but a Navy patrol saved us. When I think about that time, I'm really scared. I don't know what my destiny is. Will I die in the sea or make it to Europe? When I wake up in the morning, I have my breakfast. Then I go to the place in Rabat where I have my small shoe repair business. I'm doing well with this work. I've managed to make a living. But I don't make good money every day. Sometimes I get around $6. It all depends on the customers. But the good thing is, I'm working, not begging. I don't ask for help from anyone. With the money I earn, I'm able to buy clothes and pay my rent. In good times, I can even save some money, around $80 to $120. When I save that amount, I'll travel to the north of Morocco, buy a plastic boat, and with my friend, we will try to cross again. Around 2 years ago, sub-Saharan immigrants were treated really badly in Morocco. But the situation has changed since the king gave the right of some sub-Saharans to get residency cards. I haven't got mine yet, but the situation has really changed from how it was before. In the past, people would spit at us, pull our noses, say racist things. But since the start of the year, we feel that there has been a change. As soon as I can get my residency, I will find a better job and it will enable me to travel to Europe. I didn't leave my country to stay in Morocco. I have to leave whatever the price is. Despite my suffering, I will find my happiness. I will make it there, God willing.
That story comes to us from our partners at the BBC.
And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Our show is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Jenny Ament, and Eliza Mills, with help from John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we'll talk about the business of art and have some brunch. Thanks for listening. This is APM.